Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we are definitely keeping a watch on Lyft. I mean, to see what happened last night after they reported their latest quarterly results and outlook, I mean, it just fell off a cliff here, Katie.
I know, and I know that there's this duopoly between Uber and Lyft. It seems like it's increasingly in favor of Uber when you look at some of those ridership numbers.
But different models. Lyft right now, though, down about 36%. So let's get to it with Bloomberg News technology reporter Jackie DeVolos. She's writing about it. She joins us from our 99.1 studio in Washington. Jackie, happy Friday. Good to have you here with us. You're happy if you are shorting Lyft on this Friday. Talk to us about the quarter and kind of what went wrong and why everybody's so pessimistic here.
It was a rough day yesterday, but to be honest, I think Wall Street was somewhat expecting a version of a slowdown, but that profit outlook completely missed estimates. Lyft said that they would make anywhere between 5 to 15 million in adjusted earnings. Wall Street was expecting closer to 80 million, so that's a huge miss. Revenue also missed that outlook. But really what's lying underneath the surface here is that their ridership just is not coming back. You still saw that active rider growth below pre-pandemic levels. That's all the second quarter that Lyft has lagged Uber. Uber is well, you know, beyond their recovery. Their bookings for mobility, excluding delivery, is already back to where it used to be. So when you think about what Lyft has to, what lever they have to pull on, pricing is really the only thing they have left to keep some of those consumers coming back.
Well, Jackie, that was going to be my question. I mean, we know that Lyft reduced base prices for rides in January that, of course, followed a move by Uber. If that's the lever, haven't they already pulled it? How much more is there to cut?
Well, if you remember, this time around last year, all of us were griping about how expensive Uber and Lyft rides were. And you saw some of that pricing come down because that driver shortage that we were talking about last year has really eased. And so what you're seeing is Uber is starting to kind of pull back on some on how much it's extracting from some of those higher fares. It just has a better balance. Its demand and supply is in equilibrium a little bit more so than what you're seeing with Lyft. So when you think about how many customers are coming onto the platform, now Lyft is kind of seeing, well, we have pretty good driver supply. We're just not seeing those numbers really recover on the rider side. So they need to either attract more riders, and the way they're going to do that is basically sacrificing that profit and saying, you know what, we don't want to deter customers from coming onto our app versus Uber, so we're going to give you a cheaper ride.
Hey, Jackie, checking with our Bloomberg Intelligence team yesterday. I mean, one of the things that jumps out here, Lyft and Uber are not exactly the same companies. Yes, they both are in ride sharing, but Uber, you know, there's food, there's other deliveries. They are really kind of building out a little bit of a different and bigger and broader model here. And I wonder how that impacts performance.
That's absolutely right, Carol. When you think about how much Uber has built out that food delivery business, the advantages it gets is that cross-selling component. It's able to attract new rideshare customers from its food delivery business and vice versa. Lyft does not have that advantage. They basically have to just rely on pulling that pricing lever. Uber also has an international business. And what that does is it helps its algorithms get better at matching and batching drivers to rides and orders so much more efficiently. Another key differentiator is that Lyft has a scooter and bike business that makes up a greater portion of its revenue. And in seasonal months, it's going to take a bigger hit. But you couple that with the fact that the West Coast hasn't recovered nearly as much as it has for Uber's other markets. It's just taking a hit on all fronts.
And so, I mean, tell us about the path forward. I know that, Lyft already went through its own rounds of layoffs, but, you know, in trying to, bring back up the ridership and trying to control costs, I mean, should we expect more news of that type from a Lyft?
You beat me to it, Katie. That's really what's going to come next. And management was pretty forthcoming in the call yesterday after results, saying that it is taking cost-cutting measures very seriously. The next step is to, wonder where that's going to come from. They've already said that stock-based compensation is going to come down. The way they're doing that is by hiring more overseas, where you don't pay so much in stock-based comp. It's mostly cash. And so, whether that means more layoffs or perhaps hiving off other parts of the business, I think everything is on the table at this point.
But that's not a strategy forward, right? They've got to figure out how to grow the business, right? Because you can only cut costs so much. I mean, I think of the IBM equation, right? Where they were, it wasn't necessarily for a long time. They weren't growing the organic business, but they were doing good cost cutting and different measures. Having said that, you do see Lyft partnering up with Grubhub. I mean, is this their way forward to compete a little bit better with Uber?
That's a great point, Carol. Even Uber said on their own earnings call that the membership product is going to be an incredibly important way to kind of increase not just the number of people that come onto the app, but just keeping them there even longer. Lyft hasn't really leaned into it as much as some of the other gig economy peers. DoorDash and Instacart have their own. It has a partnership with Grubhub, but that's not going to be enough to really kind of get the wider scope of customers that are active in food delivery. So I think it's considering other partnerships there, but it's going to have to ramp that up a little bit more. Uber said they have over 12 million members.
Yeah.
Lyft hasn't disclosed their membership base, so.
I always wonder when there's no disclosure.
I know, typically not
a good
sign.
Is it 2 million? Is it 10 million? Is it 5? Jackie, thank you so much. Have a great weekend, Jackie DeVolos. She is our Bloomberg News technology reporter, joining us from our 99.1 studio in Washington D.C. I'm mostly an Uber household.
Yeah, no, me too. I was just looking at the share prices over the past year. Uber's down 9%.
Okay.
Lyft is down 75%.
It's a really big
tale
difference.
Of two cities.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like they're in kind of a make or break moment in many ways.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we mentioned this story in our TV simulcast earlier in the week. It's actually the international cover of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, now out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, also on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's written by Bloomberg News economics reporter Rich Miller, who notes, forget about the hard or soft economic landing and meet the rolling recession. Rich is with us via Zoom in our Washington, D.C. Bureau, along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. I feel like we keep trying to figure out how do we describe where we are, Joel?
That'd be great if you could answer that. And okay, that's why I turned to my colleagues, not unlike Rich Miller, to help answer these. And the thing that obviously everybody was keyed on was Powell and a rate decision, the Fed's rate decision, and then all of a sudden those job numbers happened, and we tacked a little bit, and that led to Rich coming back with talking about the rolling recession. So what is a rolling recession, and what does it potentially look like for the economy, Rich?
Yeah, I mean, if you're of a certain event, vintage, and if you start talking about rolling, you start thinking about that old Western rawhide. But anyway, rolling recession basically is the downturn sort of goes from one sector to the another, but you never have the entire economy go down all at once. So it's kind of a hybrid between this hard landing. We've all heard about this hard landing, you know, where we really enter a full-blown recession, unemployment goes up, you know, 2-3%, and this soft landing where we sort of steady out and, you know, the economy just grows nice and steady while inflation comes down. The rolling recession is kind of a hybrid. We get recessions, but they're in one sector, then another sector, then those sectors start to pick up a little bit, and then it goes into another sector. We've got a quote in the story from Sungwon Son, who's a economics professor out on the West Coast. He said, you know, industries and sectors take turns going down, but as opposed to everybody going down all at once. And that's what we're talking about. And I think that's probably the best we can hope for at the moment.
Do we have a blueprint for the rolling recession? Have we seen this happen before? And if so, I mean, what does that tell us about what we could be heading into?
Yeah, I mean, it has happened a couple of times before. I mean, the term sort of got coined first sort of in the mid-1980s. We had a big drop in oil prices, and that really devastated the oil patch in Houston. And we also had sort of a change in tax law that really hit the commercial real estate. And everybody thought, oh, here we go. We're heading into a recession. But there were folks like Ed Yardeni, who's still around analyzing stock markets, who said, no, it's a rolling recession. We're going to see it in commercial real estate. We're going to see it we're going to see it in the oil patch, but we're not going to see it. The other rolling recession people talk about is in 2016, when we had the manufacturing sector got hit by a very strong dollar. Agriculture prices were going down, so the farm sector got hit, but the rest of the economy didn't hit. Some pundits, you know, say the pain, though, that the heartland of America faced helped get Trump reelected that year. I'll leave that to political pundits. But anyway, we didn't get a full blown recession in either of those episodes, and that's what some people are hoping it's going to happen this time.
Okay, so how are we going to know if we're in a rolling recession, or are we already in one and we just haven't, you know, had it?
Well, I mean, we're sort of in one. I guess we're in one in the sense that we've seen housing go down first as the Fed raised interest rates, and then manufacturing is now kind of going down, and tech is going down. So you do see it rolling, and arguably you see the first one who was rolling in, which was housing, is starting to stabilize maybe, and there's some hints with mortgage rates having come down that, you know, maybe that market's going to stabilize. And then the next one to go would be more like the service sector part of the economy. And as that happens, hopefully the other ones are sort of stabilizing and coming back up. I mean, but, you know, I mean, the worst comes to worst is that, you know, the service sector doesn't just sort of, you know, slow. It sort of caves in, basically.
Hey, Rich, what I'm curious about, so if it's a rolling recession, does ultimately the National Bureau of Economic Research say we were in a recession, or because it kind of works its way through, is it officially still a recession?
Well, I mean, if it works the way those two other episodes were, neither of those episodes were classified as a
technical
recession.
I love that. Yeah, like, sign me up.
It's recession, but we're just not going to use the word.
right. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're in the housing market and the home builders, you know, they say they're in recession, right? You know, and if you ask somebody who you know, some of the manufacturing companies, like we have 3M, which makes, you know, pretty much almost everything you can think of, Post-it notes and computer consoles, et cetera. You know, they're laying off people, so it feels like a recession to them. But, you know, you ask the airlines, and you know, everything's hunky-dory, mm-hmm. basically, mm-hmm. you know, so.
And so, Rich, I wanted to jump in and ask, I mean, it feels like soft landing. It was a dirty word for a little bit. We sort of wrote it off as definitely not happening. Now I'm seeing more people make the argument that we could get it. The counter to that would be that a soft landing is just a precursor to a hard landing. A hard landing at the start looks like a soft landing. I mean, what's the current thinking on if there is a binary outcome, if it's not a rolling recession, which one is more likely?
Well, I think people were becoming more sympathetic to the idea of a soft landing. I mean, there's yet another sort of, you know, one making the rounds now, which is kind of, you know, to further complicate things, which is something called a no landing.
Come on, people.
right. You know, which is basically coming off the very spectacular jobs gains we were reported in January, so that, you know, so the economy basically, you know, has slowed. It definitely has slowed, but like, it's like, you know, it then it kind of reaccelerates, and that people would think if it reaccelerates and inflation reaccelerates with it, we'd eventually get a hard landing because the Fed would say, you know, enough is enough and really slam on the brakes. But
then there's maybe a landing or 50-50 recession or I don't know, recession.
Whatever the landing is when Biden says shoot it down.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's the chatbot recession. I mean, we could just go on. Love it, love it, love it. So relevant. Rich Miller, thank you so much. Bloomberg News economics reporter. The story in the upcoming issue, the cover of the issue is on the Adani Empire. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
We wanted to talk a little bit about the crypto world. And in fact, for the next half hour or so, we're going to kind of dig deep into the crypto world because there's a bunch of stories out, including SEC Chair Gary Gensler talking about the settlement with crypto exchange Kraken over stalking digital assets. And he said it should put everyone on notice in this marketplace. The SEC Chair catching up with Bloomberg's David Westin earlier on Bloomberg TV and radio. Check it out.
These storefronts, these crypto exchanges, crypto lending platforms, crypto staking as a service, they need to come into compliance, and they are generally non-compliant right now. The investing public is not only at risk by the speculative nature of crypto, but they're at risk of ending up in line in a bankruptcy court because a lot of these platforms are doing things they're not disclosing.
All right, that, of course, was the SEC chair, Gary Gensler, earlier on Bloomberg TV and radio with David Westin. Let's talk about the crypto space more broadly, and especially when it comes to the regulatory front. With our crypto roundup, let's kick it off with Stacey Marie Ishmael. She's managing editor for crypto right here at Bloomberg News. Yes. Lucky for us, bless you, Katie. She is in our interactive brokers studio. Stacey, thank you so much. We're so excited to have you here. So you heard Gensler.
Yep.
He's out there talking big time. What's your takeaway?
I think one of the fun things about reporting in crypto is every day you wake up and you're like, what slightly unexpected thing may happen today? And for a lot of the folks who've been paying attention, especially in the back half of 2022 after the collapse of FTX, we've sort of been waiting to see when the SEC was going to do the thing that they've hinting they wanted to do for a while, which is come out and say, here are all of the ways that we find the industry to be non-compliant. And we have absolutely seen, particularly in January, from the SEC, from Gensler himself, that they're like, well, okay, here are all the ways that you have been non-compliant. And we think that the crackdown on staking is just the latest example of them trying to remind both the crypto industry, but also traditional finance, that regulations do exist and they will enforce them.
Can you guys both remind us what staking is, just for those who don't
know?
That
was going to be my next question. If I were 5 years old, how would you explain staking? Or, you know, if I was in puberty, how would you do it?
Do you like free money?
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay.
Because if you like free money and you happen to have some imaginary money in the form of, say, Ether or Bitcoin or another token, you could agree to have a big crypto exchange like a Kraken or a Coinbase hold that money for you, that token, and pay you a return of anywhere up to 20-21%. And in exchange, they would use your tokens to validate other transactions in crypto. And that's staking.
So how does that work? Because, I mean, the sort of the curmudgeon's cry against crypto is that it doesn't have any cash flow. Mm-hmm. So how does it actually generate that money?
It's partly that what staking does is for the folks who are doing the staking. So if you're Kraken or a Coinbase and you're saying, okay, we have a bunch of these tokens, we're going to use them to help validate transactions, they also generate returns on those things. So you're sort of participating in a yield-generating ecosystem. Mm. This is the pitch. But of course, the argument from the SEC is exactly like, well, you as an investor, somebody who likes free money, are looking to these other entities to generate value for you. And something like that starts to look, sound, and feel like what they would consider a security to be.
And of course, we did get the news yesterday that crypto exchange Kraken, like you mentioned, they made a deal with the SEC over their staking program. They're going to pay $30 million to settle those allegations that it broke the agency's rules when it comes to staking products. Kraken isn't the only one that does this, though. Give us a sense of the landscape.
So there are different types of players in this ecosystem. The other one that I mentioned, Coinbase, you know, in the aftermath of the Kraken settlement with the SEC, Brian Armstrong, all of Coinbase's lawyers, they're all like, here are all of the ways the thing we do is not like the thing that Kraken does. So, you know, it's very much in the interest of all of the other crypto players to try to identify how they are either compliant with whatever the rule is, or however the rule doesn't apply to them. And what we fully expect from the SEC, and especially from the tenor of the comments that you just heard with his interview on TV, is that they're going to say, no, that loophole actually probably does apply to you. And if you think it doesn't, just give us some time.
I've got to say, to me, it just doesn't even sound like a business, because the whole point is if somebody calls in their stake, am I missing?
I mean, I think this is kind of one of the fun things. It's like, okay, so if somebody were to try to call in their stake, you know, it's not like a traditional run on the bank per se, right?
Okay.
It's not this idea of the exchanges or whoever has this money is necessarily going to run out of the ability to offer this thing to you.
Okay.
Which, to be clear, has happened in other circumstances, but the Krakens and the Coinbases of the world are very well capitalized. And Coinbase, especially as a U.S. traded publicly listed company, has audited financials. They can show you how well capitalized they are. So the concern from the SEC is more like other people who do similar things have to play by more rules. And we want to be clear that these rules apply to you.
So, I mean, Coinbase, of course, like you said, they're going to make the argument that ours is different, et cetera, et cetera. But then you look at what's going on in the shares. And of course, Coinbase has had a really great start to 2023, along with everything else crypto, but was down 14% yesterday. It was down 4% today. I look at that. It seems like the thinking is that maybe those arguments aren't necessarily going to hold water at the SEC.
I think there's a lot of jitteriness right now because in addition to the comments about staking, you also have, as Bloomberg News, my colleagues there, confirmed that the New York regulators are looking into a company called Paxos, which issues a stablecoin. The stablecoins are the ones that are supposed to be stable. Like, they're not supposed to move up and down in the way that other tokens do. That is the thing. And, you know, we just published a story a couple of minutes ago that PayPal, which was looking to issue its own stablecoin, have been like, haha, we may not. Regulatory uncertainty is a little bit stressful. And so, you know, you're seeing this real, I wouldn't say shift in sentiment because sentiment hasn't been great, but a pause in the rally that we saw in January as people try to figure out what might be coming next.
Stacey, in terms of the regulatory framework that ultimately gets established, is it going to be piecemeal as things go wrong or as a disaster happens? Is that how it's going to probably develop and evolve?
That is 100% the most common criticism of all regulators, that it's like they're regulating the last war. And what's been interesting for about the past few months is, you know, folks were jumping up and down to the SEC and saying, what are you doing about consumer protection? Like, how are you going to stop there being another XYZ files for bankruptcy and then like a week later, another XYZ files for bankruptcy? And so they are very much in a position where they got all of this criticism that they weren't fast enough, they weren't aggressive enough, and they're trying to respond, which immediately leads to people saying, no, that's too aggressive. We don't want you to kill the whole industry. Or the common criticism right now is, well, you're just going to cause people in the US to try to transact offshore and overseas, right, where they may have even fewer investor protections.
Well, that's the thing, right? Didn't Kraken say that they're only... this only applies to their U.S. business.
That's exactly right.
That's still going to happen overseas.
That's exactly right.
That's so interesting. So, I mean, but is that a solvable problem? Obviously, the SEC has jurisdiction over the U.S. It feels like, you know, if you think about this as a multi-headed beast, they can only be responsible for cutting off one head.
And this is entirely why, you know, like the Davos elite, as it were, one of the big talking points there from regulators, from central bankers is, hey, we have to have a unified front on crypto regulation. This is a global asset class. It's functionally borderless. We have to have baseline standards in which we are coordinated and aligned, because otherwise, to your point, it's going to be, you know, you try to chop off a head, you play whack-a-mole, like pick some kind of frustrating metaphor, and folks will find ways to work around those.
Do the regulators, do they understand it at this point?
Yes. I mean, I think there is a very common misconception that it's like, oh, the Fed doesn't know what they're doing. The Fed knows exactly what they're doing. The various central banks know what they're doing. They have hired from industry. They are doing their own, you know, to use the popular crypto phrase, they're doing their own research. They are issuing policy papers. They are doing demos of how you could run a blockchain. So you're dealing with an increasingly sophisticated regulatory environment in a way that may not have been true 2 years ago.
Does it feel like it's going to be a better year, a smarter year when it comes to crypto?
My question to that would be like, what side of the fence are you on? Because, you know, depending on how you're positioned, this could go very well or very poorly for you.
As a journalist,
I have no positions.
Would imagine, though, that you're going to be busy.
Yeah, that seems to be the theme, you know, and I think that we're also seeing the stories evolve, right? We are seeing different types of very traditional financial institutions making their own plays in different types of crypto things. We're seeing tech companies trying to figure out how are they going to compete. You know, if you are an Apple Wallet, you might want to know, like, what's our crypto strategy?
Do we maybe hear more about blockchain versus crypto? Just got about 10 seconds.
The underlying technology, 100%.
That's what I thought. I've already had. It just feels like I can see the evolution already. Stacey, thank you so much. Really great deep dive. Stacey Maria Schmel, Managing Editor for Crypto at Bloomberg News, right here in studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
crypto world for a little bit. We've got a good guest coming up. We're going to talk about the energy used when it comes to crypto mining, because I don't know, Katie, you know stats really well in this world, but about 60% of global currency mining is fueled by coal and natural gas as opposed to renewable energy sources. I mean, you've done a lot of reporting. This is a big issue.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this has been one of the pain points for the industry. There's a lot of pain points right now, it makes them vulnerable. The fact that you're wasting, some would say, this much energy, it's an easy point to attack.
All right. So that is what we do want to kind of attack with our next guest. In our weekly crypto segment, with us is Kent Halliburton, President and Chief Operating Officer at SAS Mining, which connects investors to renewable energy mining facilities. He joins us via Zoom in Portugal. Hey, Kent, good to have you here with Katie and myself. First of all, tell us a little bit about your company and your background.
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for having me. So I made a pivot in my personal career from the solar electric industry to Bitcoin mining because I saw its environmental potential. And here at SAS Mining, we're actually transforming the way people relate with money and energy. We actually just launched our first turnkey hydropower data center in Wisconsin to make Bitcoin mining easy and accessible for every person. Just going to our website is easy. The Netflix subscription, you can get started with a mining rig of your own and receive rewards directly to your wallet. We never custody our customers' Bitcoin. And on top of that, we've also just kicked off a crowdfunding campaign through Start Engine so that anybody that wants to participate with this transformation with us can do so by owning a piece of SAS Mining. And we're just making it easy.
So let's talk a little bit more about your business model, because, you know, when I hear sustainable Bitcoin mining company, sometimes that simply means that you're buying offsets or using credits somehow. But so are you actually, it's a hydro-powered facility, correct?
Correct. We're actually purchasing the power directly from the dam operator himself.
And so, you know, you mentioned, and I see in your notes that you just launched a facility in Wisconsin. And a conversation I have around crypto mining all the time is how different states treat it. What about Wisconsin? What led you there?
Well, what led us there was a combination of the facility itself. So we've got a clean energy mandate. All the Bitcoin mining that we do is carbon neutral. And, you know, we took a step back and said, look, this energy thing, it is a serious concern, but at the end of the day, we need to have a little bit more of a nuanced conversation to separate electricity from carbon. Carbon is the culprit when it comes to climate change, which I've been a part of, you know, advocating against my entire career, being in both solar and now in Bitcoin mining. But we need to figure out ways to mine Bitcoin with carbon neutral sources. And there's quite a few of them out there. And in fact, the network, last stats I saw, was improving at about 4% per annum in its carbon neutrality.
So help me out, and Katie, you're a crypto expert. Why isn't it just all renewables? Is it just access, cost? What is it? And Ken, come on in. Like, why is it, you know, what are the difficulties? Since this is such, as Katie mentioned, a pain point, why isn't it just all of the mining done through renewable sources?
Well, at the end of the day, we first need to kind of take a step back and think about the grid itself, right? So when it comes to the grid, it's kind of surprising, I think, for some folks to realize that it's an on-demand situation. So it's a complicated navigation where you've got power on the grid and it has to be consumed as it's produced. So there's this constant balancing act for energy producers. And renewables, hydro is a consistent baseload energy on the grid, but renewables have a lot of variation and fluctuation. And for Bitcoin mining, what we are looking for as miners is the lowest cost energy. And that's energy that's often discarded or unused. So actually, there's quite a bit that's been going on with renewables. Specifically, hydro has been a major power source. But the coal has actually been an issue primarily in China and Kazakhstan. And Bitcoin mining has left those places. So if you look at the most recent stats, actually, it's growing more renewable, actually, quite quickly, day over day.
Well, Ken, something I always wonder about when I have these conversations about how to make crypto mining greener is where this falls on the priority list. Because you talk to crypto miners over the past year, really, and it feels like the focus has just been survival, as we've seen the price of Bitcoin in particular really plummet and their margins just basically get eaten up. So when you think about the mining industry as a whole, outside of just SaaS mining, I mean, do you think that it just isn't that high of a priority item right now, that people are still just trying to survive?
No, I think it's absolutely a priority. I think there's a deep-seated worry in the industry right now for Bitcoin miners in the United States, right? Like, we can't control what's happening in the rest of the world, but a Bitcoin mining industry in the US sees that there's a regulatory risk right now. If you're not mining Bitcoin in a carbon neutral way, which actually the White House advocates for, you know, they came out, the Office of Science and Technology, with a report saying, look, we've got a methane mitigation issue right now, and Bitcoin mining is actually one of the few economical opportunities we have to avoid this. And methane is a greenhouse gas that has up to an 84 times more impactful on climate change than carbon.
You know, it's interesting. And you say the hydropower is more reliable. There isn't kind of some instability in that because of climate change?
Well, there is, definitely. There's definitely some seasonality with water flows. Where we are in Wisconsin, we analyzed the water flows for the last 5 years and saw that there was only 1 month in 5 years that there could be a potential dip in electricity prices or in electricity output, in which case the beauty of Bitcoin mining is it can be curtailed. And we have that arrangement built in with the dam power producer.
Okay, so another question that I have sort of existentially is, you know, part of the reason, a big part of the reason why Bitcoin mining is so energy intensive is because it's proof of work. Basically, that really, just to simplify it for simplicity's sake, that requires a lot of energy. We saw the Ethereum blockchain go to proof of stake. And I remember at the time, you know, the number that kept getting tossed around was what? It was going to cut energy usage by 98, 99%. Don't quote me on that. It's a simple question. Why can't the Bitcoin blockchain just go from proof of work to proof of stake? Doesn't that seem like sort of an elegant solution?
Well, it would seem like it on the surface, right? But you actually have to look a little bit more deep, and I don't want to get too bogged down with the technicality, but at the end of the day, proof of work and proof of stake are two different consensus mechanisms. And there's a strong argument to be made that there's a centralizing force within proof of stake over time. And one of the keys that Bitcoin has been designed around is decentralization and security. And that's where the proof of work comes in. Without proof of work, you actually can't really reliably have decentralization over the long time period. Now we'll see, maybe we can, but thus far, we haven't seen where proof of stake systems have been able to avoid that outcome. And the reason why people are really investing in Bitcoin is because we've had such a long period of stability. That 14 years really gives investors a lot of confidence that Bitcoin's going to be around for the future. So a massive change to proof of stake would undermine that stability that we've developed.
Ken, just got 30 seconds. The proof is in the pudding. How much is your business growing? Are you guys profitable? And just quickly.
So we are an early stage company, so we're not to profitability yet. However, we have designs that we should be there within the next year or so. But this industry has so much opportunity, and where we come in with our specific niches, we don't think that anybody has designed a great solution for the every person. And so by coming up with a platform that is accessible and easy in the best of Web 2, like customers are used to, we think we're going to break this market wide open.
Well, we appreciate your time on this Friday afternoon. Kent, thank you so much. Kent Halliburton, President and Chief Operating Officer at SaaS Mining, joining us via Zoom from Portugal. I just think about it, it's complex computations, right? They want as much power wherever you can get it, right?
And again, grid. That's what makes the industry vulnerable.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Yes, I'm counting down to the Friday closing bell. Are you counting down, Katie?
Oh, we're close. We're getting closer. What, an hour, 18 minutes?
No.
I was thinking about
She's been traveling. She's been in Miami. She's been having drinks with umbrellas or something.
I keep reminding myself it's Friday. It's not actually Monday. Yeah.
It is Friday. All right, let's get to it with David Dees. I'm sure he knows exactly how many minutes until the close. He's managing principal, senior portfolio strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. $10 billion in assets under management. David with us once again on the phone in Summit, New Jersey. David, good to have you here. It's been another interesting week. I do feel like we're looking at a treasury market that's thinking a little bit different and getting the Fed memo that, yep, they're going to keep raising rates. They're going to stay higher for longer. How do you see the market environment, the investment environment right now?
Yeah, absolutely, Carol. So we basically had a Goldilocks month in January, of course, with that inflation indicator starting to come down, interest rates were coming down. We had the job market staying strong, and then all of a sudden we ran smack into the January jobs report. And with the much stronger than expected jobs, people had to start recalculating where the Federal Reserve was going. The market for a long time was saying, you know, one or two and then done and coming back down in the second half of the year. Now all bets are off. And so what we've been seeing this week, of course, is that particularly with this 10-year Treasury backing up, that's really hitting the NASDAQ stocks hard. Why? Because those are the longer so-called earnings duration stocks. And as those interest rates go up, the discounting of those earnings to present value really hits the present value hard, and that's where we're seeing the real weakness.
Having said that, though, when we first got our Fed decision, right, we saw actually a rally, didn't we, in terms of the equity market? And I think there was some, you know, we were having these questions, or we've seen with this talk of higher rates, we've seen tech rally despite it. Are you just saying that traders are finally getting it, kind of thing?
Well, you know, I think that's right. So when we first got the Fed decision, that was before the January jobs report. And although the Fed said, you know, we're staying the course, we've got to, you know, manage the job, there was still a dovish overtone in Chair Jerome Powell's message to investors. Then all bets were off. Jerome Powell, I think, took the best of it, saying we don't want to basically overreact to that January jobs number. But then we got this flurry of additional Fed speak in this past week, and that has really caused investors to recalculate where they see this Federal Reserve going. And of course, let's put it in context. The NASDAQ had its strongest January since 2001, up over 11%. And so we were due to take a pause, if not a little bit more.
Well, David, like Carol said, I've been in Miami for the past week, but even I knew that there was a lot of Fed speak this week. It was very hawkish, and as you've laid out, we've gotten some pretty important data points in the last couple of weeks. Chief among them is, of course, that non-farm payrolls report. If we look ahead to next week, we have a very important inflation print coming up on Tuesday, also Valentine's Day. But when you think about, I don't know, it feels like a real jitteriness has overtaken the market in the past couple of days. How high are the stakes heading into Tuesday in that inflation report?
Well, I think they're very high because, you know, we're coming off this, you know, over 500,000 jobs created, lowest jobless rate since 1969. And so the concern is that this labor market is going to get away from us in terms of a wage price spiral, which is going to make the Fed's job exceedingly difficult. So, yeah, all eyes are on the 8:30 Eastern Tuesday, the CPI print. But let's take it in stride here. First of all, we know what 11 of the last 12 months actually are. So we're just looking at the January number. I think the bullish case is, you know, when you look at just the 3 months of the last quarter of last year, you're only up 1.8%. So hopefully we can have something close to the flat line. I think the fly in the ointment right now that Wall Street has to get ready for is gas prices, which is an important component of the headline number, have drifted up in the month of January after backing off tremendously in Q4. And that could make for a print that doesn't resolve the question as to where inflation is going.
Yeah, we talked about energy earlier. Let's get to picks. The macro, I feel like we can go back and forth in so many directions, on any given day. But let's get to some names that you think investors should be looking at. And Pfizer is one of them. Stock's down about 14%, pays a dividend. What is it about Pfizer that you find interesting, David?
Well, it's your quintessential blue chip. And with all the concerns, will there be a recession, what type of landing and so forth, I like the healthcare sector because it's not particularly sensitive to the economy. Now, you know, where would we be in terms of coming out of COVID-19 if we didn't have Pfizer? Here's the problem for the stock is they made so much money that now investors are saying, okay, what's, you know, the encore here? How long will the valley be before you come up with your next blockbuster? But when I look at this company, the size of their labor force, their global diversification, the fact that it's only about 11 times earnings, 3.7% dividend, and close to 30% off of its 52-week high, I think this is a good place to hang out in terms of the volatility that we could have next week.
So you like healthcare, good place to hang out. Where's not a good place to hang out? Where are you avoiding right now?
Well, certainly, you know, one concerning thing about the overall market environment is the return of the speculative phase. So if it has AI or ChatGPT in its name, please look up. I mean, it makes no sense. It reminds me of, you know, 22 years ago when everyone was putting .com after their names. Now everyone's trying to figure out a way to put AI into their business model, into their name, and the prices have gotten out of sight. And I mean, you know, the Chinese government and state media have never been a bastion of, you know, kind of conservative thinking, but I love the fact that even they warned their people that the whole the stock market, insofar as AI was concerned, was getting way overheated. Caution, of course. And of course, you got some of the meme stocks are on the rise again, you know, the AMCs. And you do want to steer clear of that.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. We really appreciate it. David, thank you so much. David Dietz, he's managing principal and senior portfolio strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from Summit, New Jersey.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn. TuneIn and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success. It's discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management and investment banking firms in the industry. Stifel. It's where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.